Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. We have senior White House correspondent Weijia Zhang with us. She's hosting Face the Nation this Sunday. Good morning, Weijia.
Good morning, Colleen. Good morning to everybody.
So I'm curious, as the White House correspondent, you must keep a close eye on the administration and their coronavirus policies right now. I was reading something about their focus being sending vaccines overseas, but what about closer to home? What is the White House trying to accomplish in America when it comes to this virus?
Well, they continue to be really focused on vaccines and trying to get people vaccinated. So yesterday, the White House announced that they are throwing another $3 billion at the supply chain to make sure manufacturers and companies have the resources they need to keep production up, which is really important because starting in about less than 3 weeks, actually, those booster shots are going to start being available for people. And that, of course, is the third shot of either the Pfizer or Moderna, or second shot of Johnson & Johnson. And so those boosters are going to add more protection, according to the health officials in the administration, as we head into the winter months, the colder months. And we know that they're also keeping a close eye on how the virus is impacting children, which is really important because so many are going back to school and so many parents still have questions about what that means. So the CDC is releasing new data today about that, and we'll be drilling down on the numbers and trying to understand it better with Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Something I've been wondering, especially as a parent of an 8-year-old about to head to school in less than a week, is why was the vaccine so quickly released to 12-plus and adults? Why is it taking so long to get this vaccine out to those under 12?
You know, I think one of the big challenges was getting children under the age of 12 to be enrolled in trials, because that would require parents to say, you know, you can give my child the vaccine who's under 12, not knowing a thing about how it might affect them. So doctors have pointed to that being really difficult, because when you're a parent, you know, your number one question is, how is this going to impact my child? And if that's what you're setting out to answer, that means you don't know. And so I think a lot of parents were skeptical. But they are optimistic that the vaccine may be available to those children by the end of the year. They are being really cautious, though. Even, you know, the biggest advocates of the vaccine want to make sure this is done absolutely in the right way, because, you know, at the end of the day, if you do authorize it and give emergency use to those children, it is, you know, going into the bodies of millions and millions of kids whose parents want to know that it is the safe and right thing to do.
Right. Yeah. Who's going to hand over their child and say, sure, experiment on my child? That sounds like a good plan. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I feel like if at this point you haven't gotten the vaccine, you're pretty staunch in your belief that you're not going to get it. So does the Biden administration have any sort of plans to, I don't know, maybe even force somebody to get vaccines? Because the governor of our state, Jay Inslee, he has enacted some pretty tough rules with vaccines. State employees, they are about to lose their job in October if they don't get vaccinated. And that's caused a huge uproar. So anything strict like that about to come out of the Biden administration?
Well, the president has already implemented those mandates or require regular testing for federal employees, and members of the military have to get vaccinated. But he has been so clear from day one that he is not going to play that part in the private sector for average Americans, because, you know, he does not believe that is the role of the government. However, he is continuing to push business owners and different corporations to, you know, take the lead and follow his example for, you know, his workers, federal workers, to try to establish vaccine mandates and testing schedules. And so that really is what they're relying on, is that more people will be faced with a choice, and that choice, hopefully, in their eyes, is getting the vaccine. But you're absolutely right about the philosophy, and that's why it's so difficult, because by now, if you haven't gotten it, it's very hard to see who might be able to change your minds. And, you know, the administration says it's not just about you. It's about everybody else that you are, you know, coming into contact with. And so that's why they hope that eventually more pressure because to do that and more incentives to do that will make a difference.
Just changing topics real quick, because another big story in the country is the Texas abortion law that was allowed to go through with the U.S. Supreme Court not deciding on its constitutionality or to take up that case right now. You have a guest this Sunday out of Texas, I believe, maybe a legislator. Can you tell me more about your guest and what you'll be discussing out of Texas?
Yes, so one of our guests is Congresswoman Veronica Escobar, and she is one of the sponsors of the bill that is on Capitol Hill right now that would offer a statutory right for women to receive abortion care. So I want to talk to her about how realistic it is that that legislation or anything comparable will pass through Congress and where it lies in the priority for Congress, because of course they have so many different topics that they are trying to tackle. I also want to know what she's hearing from constituents and from women who are impacted. Is she seeing a mass exodus of people who are making plans to go out of state? What is she hearing from healthcare providers who now would be breaking the law in most cases if they continue to provide abortion care? And I want to know what she thinks the federal government can do, because the president has said he's directing various agencies to work with White House lawyers, to work with his gender policy council, to come up with options, whether it's in care for the women or whether it's in legal tools to respond. But what we don't know is what that might look like. I mean, what does she think the government can provide to help in the immediate fallout of this law? So I think she'll be a great guest, also because she's a former teacher, and we know that Texas is one of those states that is banning mask mandates in the schools. And so I think she'll be able to talk to, you know, how that's playing out now that we're seeing so many kids going back to school and so many surges in various classrooms.
Absolutely. That should be fascinating. It's senior White House correspondent Weijia Zhang. She's hosting Face the Nation this Sunday on CBS. It'll be a great program. Thanks so much, Weijia.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen playground blessed by an unusual variety
of resident historian facts. Felix Bunnell joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map. It's a quick look at the stories behind local places and things. This week, it may not have the cachet of Route 66. Route, if you will. But an Eastern Washington man is leading the charge to raise the profile of historic U.S. Route or Route 10 all across the state. Felix.
Hey, it's Route. Come on, cut that out. No.
So it's US Route 66, 10. Route 10. There you go. Only 66 can be
it's,
Route.
Yeah, it's very complicated. U.S. Route 10 is the old name for the federal highway that first crossed much of the northern United States, connecting Seattle to Detroit beginning around the late 1920s. This road was also known as a Sunset Highway. And whatever people called it, much of it was wiped out or built over the top of to create the Interstate 90 freeway in the 60s and 70s. But it turns out there are still some great stretches, in some places as much as 40 miles long, where the old two-lane highway still exists in the evergreen state. And in some cases, the old highway is what goes through the middle of a cool old rural town. You know, when they built I-90, they straightened out the route a little bit, and they bypassed many of the small towns where US 10 was once the main street. Now, there's a civic leader over in Ritzville named John Rankin. He runs a sign company, and he restored and operates the old Ritz Theater, and he's also president of the Ritzville Downtown Development Association. So with some inspiration from time spent around Route 66 in the Southwest, he's been leading an effort since 2012 to draw attention to those old stretches of Highway 10 and to those little towns like Ritzville or my personal favorite Sprague that are still charming and that still could use your business if you need gas or a sandwich or maybe a used book or an antique. Now, this is how John Rankin sums it up.
Basically, our thing is just to get more tourists off the freeway as opposed to just going to the Starbucks and McDonald's by the freeway, but to, you know, venture off a mile or so off the freeway and drive through these old towns and hopefully provide some sort of economic boost.
So the main focus of Rankin's effort so far is signage along the freeway and along the old stretches of Highway 10. Now, the state legislature devoted $50,000 to the project a few years ago, and now there are small signs at several exits along I-90, mainly in that long stretch between Moses Lake and Spokane that seems to go on for about 10,000 miles if you're trying to get to one side of the state.
Yes.
Now, these signs are brown, and they have the old U.S. highway logo, and they say Historic Washington U.S. Route 10. So, and I didn't really know this. I'd driven by these signs a few times in the last year. When you're on I-90 and if you see one of those signs, it means you can exit the freeway and then follow part of old US 10 for some distance and then easily get back on the freeway. So if you take I-90, if you get off I-90 and take old Highway 10 through Ritzville, for instance, there are some very nice and much larger vintage style Highway 10 signs along the old two-lane road. These local signs are up to the individual jurisdictions to create and install, and they help the unfamiliar drivers know they're on the right path. Now, you could do this here and there along almost all of I-90 from Idaho to Seattle. You know, there's old stretches in Spokane, in North Bend and Snoqualmie, in Issaquah, even on Mercer Island. One thing, though, there's currently no really good brochure or map showing all the stretches of Phantom Highway 10. And it really cries out for an app or maybe marking it out some way on Google Maps or Apple Maps. So you could just go to your phone and select, you know, drive the old highway and then get the turn-by-turn navigation instructions. But, you know, there's plenty of time for that. But just really want to call out John Rankin and his efforts. What a cool idea and great follow-through to make it happen and bring economic development to places like Ritzville and Sprague and just make the drive to Spokane more interesting, or the drive to Seattle if you're coming the other direction.
Right. Yeah, I suppose I have never. I always stop in Ritzville. It's 45 minutes left until you get to Spokane. It's sort of the pit stop before you get to Spokane. But, you know, just in my time as a reporter in Spokane, we pass through a lot of those small towns like Sprague, and they are so charming. But unless you're intentional about getting off the road and doing that, you wouldn't know to. So good for him.
Yeah. What I like about Sprague is from the highway, from the freeway, it looks like a little model railroad layout with like a little feed mill and the railroad tracks. When you drive into town, there's all these great old brick buildings. There's a big lot filled with old trucks. It's definitely worth getting off the highway. There's so much to see and do around the state.
Absolutely. OMAC, too. Great wineries up there. I mean, Central Washington is largely unexplored by tourists. You go from Seattle to Spokane and back. But good for that. I'm glad you're pointing this out, Felix. Thank you.
Thanks, Elaine.
The one-on-one race for Seattle mayor kicked into high gear yesterday with a big proposal from one of the candidates. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott is live with us this morning with that big idea. Hannah.
Good morning, Colleen. Yes, this came from former City Council President Bruce Harrell, and the biggest issue in the city, homelessness, of course, was the topic of discussion. Harrell opening things up at a press conference in the Green Lake neighborhood, right near the Lower Woodland Park, which has been really overrun with tents and encampments for some time now. And he opened things up with a bit of a fire at the city.
I recently demanded from the council and the mayor that they treat this crisis with the seriousness that it deserves, and I'm not convinced at all that they are doing that, both from a budgetary standpoint and from an action standpoint.
So his idea is?
The first thing we have to do is prove to the public that we're heading in the right direction. So how do we do that? We publish a plan that shows cost per unit, cost per person. It gives us a snapshot of where we are now, where the encampments are now, where the parks are not safe for children and others to play. And then we put the milestones in, where they will move, how they will move, and most importantly, the services they will get. So that will be a published plan, and we will call upon, again, the lion's share of the federal funds, the ARPA funds. You may recall we received $116 million, to be used for this crisis to get the attention that it deserves.
So in order to do that, he detailed his plan in various steps.
I recently demanded from the council.
His steps included step one.
We'll establish a minimum of 12% of the city's budget to address the housing crisis. A minimum of 12%. We're already spending around 11%. And of course, that was a number used in the Compassion Seattle Charter Amendment. And critics will say that that's an unfunded mandate and that we will have to cut services to achieve that. We will not. That is the job of the mayor to find the funding, to prioritize funding, and we will be able to do that.
The next step of his plan includes?
Number two, we'll dedicate a minimum of 50% of the new batch of American Rescue Plan Act, the ARPA funds, to services, to the homelessness crisis. Number three, we will leverage additional state and private resources through the Regional Homeless Authority.
And he said they would also have some nonprofit partnerships, which basically would allow everyone in the city, whether you want to donate $10 to the cause or, you know, $100,000 to the cause, kind of develop that kind of a platform where that can be done. And anyone who wants to help can find a way to give.
Like a GoFundMe for the city of Seattle?
Something like that. The city already does accept gifts and things like that. It's more of a kind of I got the impression it would be kind of a public messaging that, so to encourage folks who want to do that, if they want to take things into their own hands, here's how you can donate for those who are, you know, the wealthiest in the population, or even those who are not and who just want to give something to try to help. The other thing was basically just like the Compassion Seattle charter amendment ballot initiative would have done, is create 2,000 new shelter spaces within his first year in office. So this very much mirrors that Compassion Seattle ballot initiative that was struck off the ballot by a judge a little over a week ago, but is now being appealed. I want to point out that Lorena Gonzalez's campaign, that's who he's running against, of course, immediately pushed back and said, you know, he can't back up any of these promises that he's making. He's outlining some plans. It would be pretty easy to see, you know, to call him on it if he doesn't. So we'll have to see how that plays out. And they also were very critical of him not going after the wealthiest percent of those in Seattle to fund these priorities.
I'm interested. I like the idea of publishing the plans and laying out the maps of where they're targeting is the wrong word because it makes it sound, you know, nefarious.
Right.
But, you know, here's exactly where the camps are. Here's how we're going to focus our energies on getting those camps cleaned up and the people into some services. So I like that. But I also wonder if it opens those camps up to targeted attacks or people who are unhappy with their presence, knowing exactly where they are.
Everybody knows where they are at this point. You know what I mean?
You think?
I feel like I do.
Maybe it's because I'm in the suburbs, which so many of our listeners are, but I basically just avoid Seattle because it sounds like a mess. I don't, other than Broadview Thompson Elementary, that's the one next to a park where a troubled homeless camp is, right?
Right.
Broadview Thompson K-8. That's pretty much the only large camp I know of because they cleaned up the jungle, which was that other notorious camp.
Right. And if you enter Seattle anywhere, even if it's on I-5, you're going to see where these homeless encampments are. If you come in the city, you'll know where they are. That's all there is to it. They're everywhere. There are 4,000 unsheltered people out on the streets living in encampments right now. That was an exacerbated number because of the pandemic, because they stopped turning over shelter beds during the pandemic for safety reasons. And Seattle looks so much different than it did even just a few years ago right now.
Yeah.
So I get what you're saying. I think that's not something I've seen be a big, big issue in the past. What I do think is publishing the plan is a great idea, and it could lead to some good accountability. Because if you make those promises and you publish that plan and you don't deliver, you're not going to get reelected.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you, Hannah Scott.
You bet.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross. I'm sure you've heard about the new abortion bill passed in Texas, which seems to have made abortions impossible to get for all practical purposes. But it's written in a very specific way to get around the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision. So I thought we'd talk with Lillian Lanier, who's the political director for NARAL Pro-Choice Washington. I know how you obviously know how you feel about this law, but it seems to be pretty cleverly written. I mean, the law expressly prohibits any state official from blocking an abortion, but says anybody else can file a lawsuit. So does this represent a major loophole that other states could exploit if they wanted to?
You know, I think the Texas law is truly unprecedented, and the Supreme Court's inaction, or rather their refusal to prevent it from going into effect, is concerning in that it could lead other states to model similar abortion bans.
I think they feel paralyzed, though. I think they're confused about what to do because, technically speaking, the state is not involved in this.
The state has written the law in a very crafty way that absolves state elected officials from responsibility of enforcing the law. And as you say, that power has been given to citizens who can sue anyone who they believe to have supported someone to seek an abortion after 6 weeks. But it is significant that because this law has not yet had its day in court, that this law has still been able to go into effect, has cut off vital abortion access for millions of Texans.
Well, they're scared about being sued. And I see the Texas Right to Life has set up a website where anybody can file anonymous tips about someone being pregnant and seeking an abortion. My question is, how would you go about proving this in court unless you had access to somebody's medical records, which, as I understand, are confidential under federal law?
It's a great question. You know, I myself am not a legal scholar, but I think what is so terrifying about this law is that it does invite citizens or residents anywhere in the country to file a lawsuit if they suspect someone to have helped someone get an abortion after 6 weeks. So regardless of what the evidence is, the fact that a lawsuit like that can go forward and that these anti-abortion extremists have the potential opportunity to win over $10,000 for winning one of these lawsuits is really terrifying and, you know, is an unprecedented step to empowering private citizens to police their neighbors.
But again, I can't figure out how would you prove it? You'd have to have, I mean, technically the law is about the fetal heartbeat, which typically occurs at 6 weeks. So you'd have to have the ultrasound record. You'd have to have proof of intent, I guess, if someone was driving the woman to the clinic, that they were conspiring to get the abortion. So you'd stake out the clinic and have to take photographs? I mean, you'd have to do a lot of private detective work, it seems to me, to make this stick.
And the fact that it even sets up private citizens to be surveying their neighbors and community members in that way is incredibly significant. And as you say, this applies not just to clinic staff or to abortion providers themselves, but to a friend who may lend money to cover the cost of the procedure or a Lyft driver who takes someone to the clinic. Patients who are past 6 weeks will need to travel out of state. And you know, that comes with increased costs in terms of travel, in terms of taking time off work, in terms of finding childcare. And it may be that those barriers prove insurmountable to patients who need abortion access. And, you know, there are Texans who will be forced to carry pregnancies to term against their will. Right. Those barriers will be most substantial for, you know, low-income patients, for rural, Black, Indigenous, people of color, LGBTQ plus folks, and young Texans who already face increased barriers to healthcare access. Patients will face unintended pregnancy in Texas for a whole host of reasons. And this law explicitly violates the right to access abortion and vital health care. And regardless of any actions that patients may face, barriers to healthcare access, you know, are so connected to, you know, being able to talk to a provider, being able to afford the deductible or out-of-pocket costs that come with accessing a procedure. And it puts abortion out of reach for many, many Texans.
Does NARAL have any plans to challenge this? And if so, on what grounds?
NARAL itself is not a legal advocacy organization, so we are not the group that will be doing so. But there are providers and advocacy groups and legal groups in Texas and nationally who do have active legal challenges going against this case and do anticipate that this law will have its day in court in the coming months.
Lillian Lanier is the political director of NARAL Pro-Choice Washington. Lillian, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, David.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. New Orleans is no stranger to disaster. Hurricane Ida is just the latest, but the Big Easy sure knows how to take care of their own.
The soul of a city comes from the heart of its people.
Have a great day. God bless you.
Thank you so much.
We take care of each other, I think, in a way that nobody else does.
Wow. Howie Kaplan owns the Howlin' Wolf, a place that's known for bringing people together through music.
We can fit about 1,200 people in here.
Really?
This is what we do. This is what the Howlin' Wolf is.
Okay.
We are a live music venue that does brass bands and events.
In the aftermath of Hurricane Ida, they're now using food to accomplish that same goal.
But these guys aren't just the chefs. These are managers. These are cooks. These are busboys. These are everybody. We've got folks working here from about 20 different restaurants over the last few days.
Truckloads of bread, produce, and proteins have been donated by restaurants and markets that were unable to keep things cold. Mike DeSumine runs several of those restaurants.
We just didn't even think about it. We just jumped in and started, started cooking, because that's what we do.
Lines of people show up for food starting at noon, and it's not just for families that live nearby. We saw National Guard troops, police officers, and utility workers.
How's the food?
It's awesome.
You're welcome.
People in Louisiana are anxious to get their power back on, but the Howlin' Wolf is proof.
I get smiles and I get hugs.
You don't need the lights on to feel the electricity of this city.
It's not about the money. It's about making sure that folks are taken care of and make sure that people recognize how important New Orleans really is.
Mireya Villarreal, CBS News, in New Orleans, Louisiana.
I always love hearing those stories of hope come out of disaster. It's always there. The human spirit, the human kindness is always there. You just have to look for it. And we love to share it here in the Daily Dose of Kindness. I would love to share local stories of kindness for the Daily Dose of Kindness. If you know of something good happening in your community, of someone who you think is particularly kind, you can email me. It's COBrian@Bonneville.com. You can text the show 98973. You can contact us through the inbox at mynorthwest.com. Lots of ways to contact us and share your stories of kindness coming out of your community. Look forward to hearing from you. And the next topic is a sensitive one. Just keep that in mind. But it has some positivity to it as well. Some good numbers. Snohomish County launched a new task force to help combat youth suicide, and they are seeing progress. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott here with the details. Hannah?
Good morning, Colleen. Yes, this is Snohomish County's launched this task force, the Youth Suicide Prevention Task Force. Here's what we know. Suicide is preventable, and yet it is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. And it is very high here in Washington State as well. In fact, in Snohomish County, suicide is the highest cause of death among 10 to 17 year olds and the second highest for 15 to 24 year olds. But during the pandemic, from August 2019 to August of 2020, this task force found some interesting numbers. This is Wendy Birch. She's with the youth task force that just started.
The first thing we have.
That is Bruce Harrell. Let me get to the right one. 1 second. She says that the numbers were different than they were not the highest at all.
August to August. So August of 2019 to August of 2020, we actually had zero youth suicides. And so I've been doing this work for about 20 years, and we've never gone a whole 12-month chunk with no youth suicides. And again, we were all kind of listening to the media and hearing all this, oh my gosh. So our group met. And to specifically talk about that, because we like, okay, what happened during that 12-month time? Because we really need to look at that, but even though it's a positive thing. So we need to build on what may have happened during that time.
So that is a huge, huge difference.
It's
never before.
Unbelievable. I'm happy
I know
about it, but it's almost unbelievable that there would be none. I'm happy to hear it. Did she give any hints of what they may be thinking as the cause?
Well, what they have done, this task force that's met a few times now, is go out and talk to kids to find out what they call are the risk and protective aspects that led to this outcome. Again, so because, that can lead to future policy decisions, maybe some changes that should be made to get to that outcome every year, right? So here is some of what they found.
The first one was kids were getting more sleep. It sounds very basic. Huh. And, mm-hmm. Okay, why? Why would that be impactful? Well, there are studies that show that kids that have more sleep during the school year tend to be more healthy. They're more alert. They're not affected as much by stressful incidents. They had more family time because they were home and more family interaction. They got to be with their pets. Again, it sounds very basic, but having a pet is actually a protective factor for youth who struggle with their mental health.
So as I was talking with her, I thought every single thing that you're saying applies to my daughter.
And it applies to adults, too. I mean, I'm hearing that going, that's exactly what my psychiatrist told me before I took my month break in July, was, Colleen, I think you're overwhelmed. You're stressed out. And that's why you're having these negative thoughts. That's why you're struggling, you know, with your memory issues. And so it makes sense that it applies to kids, too.
Sure. Absolutely. My kid was doing her homework. She was sleeping in and had the dog with her on the bed and throughout the entirety of remote learning, and loved that. It made her happy. Here's some of the other things that they found that were positives from this.
Less juggling of commitments, so they didn't feel as overextended. Less bullying because they weren't in a school setting. More flexibility in terms of scheduling. So they had an opportunity to take ownership of when they did their schoolwork, how long they worked on their schoolwork. Actually, the youth I talked to, that was a big one for them. I'm not sitting in a classroom from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. I can flex when I do my work. You know, I sleep in a little bit. That was a protective factor.
And my daughter took full advantage of that.
I mean, but isn't that all of us with the remote work from home, too? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know we tend to treat children like they're a different species of human, but they really are just a smaller version of us, right? Like they are full-fledged humans who have the same needs and wants and desires as adults do. We just tend to treat them differently. This is really promising, Hannah, because these are all attainable goals for parents. It's
Absolutely.
Not like you're asking to go find them a therapist and get them on medication and, you know, jump through hoops. We're just get them a pet, let them sleep in, give them flexible homework hours. Don't overload them with activities. I mean, this is all things we can do for our kids.
And I think so. And I hope that policymakers kind of take note of this, because I think the old school way of doing things that we've done in this country for so long isn't necessarily what works anymore in the day of social media, when, as the state schools chief will tell you, like every kid, especially like by the time they get to middle and high school, they're all anxious. They're all stressed out in a way that I never saw when I was in high school. And a good reason, much of that is due to social media, is anecdotally what I've heard and what I personally believe. I want to get to a couple of the other big protective factors that they found here.
Less academic pressure. So remember, all the testing was called off. Less distraction and chatter, you know, when you're in a classroom, especially if you struggle with ADD or ADHD, or you have an anxiety disorder. Again, you're in a comfortable surrounding rather than in a classroom. And then a big one we did talk about was supervision. And what we heard in the media, well, these kids are going to be home maybe in an unhealthy environment, so that will increase their risk, which is true. But we know that the data tells us that when youth die by suicide, they typically do it when they're alone.
So that's a huge thing. It's like interrupting the gun violence when we talk about, you know, shootings out on the street. If that little thing, the fact that mom's in the other room working remote in her office, could be what stops that from happening. Really quickly, though, and I know we're short on time, there is the flip side of this, which is the risk factors. And they wanted to be sure and acknowledge that. And here's what they found there.
They didn't know what was going to happen the next day or the next week or the next month in regard to school. That increases their anxiety levels. And then a lot of the people in the group work in schools, and they said, we have students who have just completely disengaged from school. Like, we haven't heard from them since school shut, and we can't track them down. We just haven't heard from them. So that was worrisome.
So those are the things. And then more access to firearms also when kids are home, if mom and dad are not in the home. There's a lot more to this. They're taking this group, and they're going to use it first and foremost to try to come up with some local policies here in the county to inform, get teachers, counselors, coaches, hopefully in the long run, every adult in the school area to be more positive, to recognize signs of suicide, to ask kids if that's something they're thinking about, and to reinforce positive messaging for them. Some of this will take legislative action at the state level. I'll have much more about it on mynorthwest.com later today if anyone's interested.
I was just going to ask if it'll be on mynorthwest.com, because I imagine parents are going to want to pass this around to other parents as well. I know I just joined the PSO at my school, so I'm going to give it to the PSO board and say, hey, can we help enact some changes at our school? So thank you, Hannah.
You bet. And really quick before we go, I just want to put out there, if anyone is in crisis, 1-800-584-3578, National Suicide Hotline.
You can also text 741-741 if you're shy about talking. I think that text line is important, too. Thank
Absolutely.
You, Hannah.
You bet. You can ring my bell.
Rachel Bell. See you. Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien, along with Heather Bosch. This morning, we're going to talk with Rachel Bell about weddings. And Rachel, I had a really nice wedding. It wasn't like extravagant, put you in debt wedding, but it was a nice one. And I always remember people telling me, spend the money on an extravagant honeymoon. Why do you want a wedding? And now I'll come to find out you don't have to spend a ton of money. You can rent wedding cakes.
You can rent everything. So everything. We are still deep in wedding season. And I think wedding season is lasting longer than usual because so many people put off their weddings during the pandemic. Everybody's quickly getting married right now before, you know, the Delta variant gets too bad. And so there was this article in the New York Times that said that you can rent every single thing for your wedding. And some of these ideas aren't new. You know, they talk about renting a wedding dress and a veil, which is something my mom did in the 1970s. But there's this shoe company, or rather, it's like a just kind of like Rent the Runway. It's called Wardrobe, where you can rent shoes and clothes. The difference is Rent the Runway, they own all of the clothes and they rent them to you. With Wardrobe, it is just regular people that are being funneled through this website renting you their shoes. So it says you can rent Manolo Blahnik pumps for $25. You could get Chanel heels for $27. They have Dolce & Gabbana, Jimmy Choo.
And those are usually hundreds of dollars, right? I wouldn't
know.
Oh,
yeah. Like the Christian Louboutin pumps are $800 new, but you can rent them for $25. So it's amazing. But I was surprised about the individual part. So it said the person renting your shoes gets 70% of the rental price, and then the rest goes to Wardrobe.
Sure.
But the thing that surprised me from this list was renting a cake. Have you heard of this before?
Never. Never.
Okay. So I was so confused. And it started with this woman named Kimberly Aya, and she's a cake baker. And the first time she set up at a bridal show, she said 99% of the brides asked if they could rent her fake display cakes that she had just, you know, on the table so they could see what she could do. And so she pivoted and started that business, and it's called Fun Cakes. So basically they are cakes made out of styrofoam, but then she uses real fondant and these, you know, sugar flowers and all that kind of stuff. And so I do not understand why people want this, except for the fact that the cheap ones are pretty cheap. So they range from $200 to $3,000 to rent. And then you have to have another cake for people to eat anyway. So it says you just get a sheet cake. So I guess you have like a beautiful stunt cake and then just like a crappy supermarket cake for people to eat.
I guess it's part of decorations that also looks nice in pictures rather than, you know, if you're on a budget, you don't want to be cutting into a sheet cake and looking back on that. You want everything to look beautiful and fantasy-like at your wedding.
And so that couples can still do the ceremonial first cut together, you know, with their hands together. On the bottom tier, they have a little section that you fill, it recommends, with three Twinkies so that you can actually cut through it just, you know, to have your picture taken, and then you go eat the sheet cake.
When I think about all the silly traditions that we still do at weddings, I look back at mine, which is this October will be 10 years for my husband and I. I know, 15 altogether, but 10 married. And, you know, I think about we did the dumb garter thing, and I think about my dad and the older generation sitting there watching him use his mouth to take a garter off, and I go, why do we do these things still? And why did I do that? I've never considered myself a trend follower.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I still went through those dumb wedding rituals. You know, the first dance where we tried to do a little choreography, you know, all the cringy stuff. But I loved my wedding. It was fun. It was a good party.
I mean, there's something to that because, you know, tradition is, I was going to say important, I guess not to all people, but I like tradition because, you know, there is something to doing the same stuff and that's kind of what establishes culture. But you're right. Like, you look back on some of the things that are tradition, you're like,
we're going to go get remarried down in Vegas this October, hopefully, if everything's still open. Yeah, of course, because I want to do it. We went to the person who was ordained to marry us. We did like premarital counseling with her, and that's how she created our vows. But I really want to, now that we've had 10 years together of marriage and children and all the ups and downs, I feel like I really want to write my own vows now. So maybe as I'm growing up and, you know, more experienced in marriage, I want to do things different for
our wedding.
So
one other thing on this list, which we may have talked about before, that you can rent a bridesmaid. I know over the years there's been all these stories like you can rent a boyfriend to bring home for Christmas and pretend it's your boyfriend. And so there's a couple companies that they talk about. One is founded by a woman who said that a lot of her friends weren't able to be bridesmaids in her wedding last year. And so she decided, you know what, I'm going to fill in that gap. So she will show up in a dress. She says she'll provide emotional support and help the bride with her big day, starting at $750.
Nice.
And then there's another woman, her company's called Bridesmaid for Hire in Brooklyn, and she says that she has been a professional bridesmaid in more than 150 weddings over the past 7 years, and hers get pricey. So you can pay a la carte. So if you want event session, that's $200 an hour. Wedding day of coordinator, that is between $1,700 and $2,900. And her most popular is the full-on bridesmaid role, which means not only will she help you, according to this article, deal with wedding day drama, she'll be there at your bridal shower and your bachelorette party. She'll be your sounding board and help you with everything. And that starts at $2,500.
I think that that's a genius idea to rent a bridesmaid. I only had four. And here's the thing about bridesmaids. I only talked to one of those bridesmaids 10 years later, and it's my sister. So, you know, I think friendships in the moment of your marriage don't necessarily represent the friendships you're going to have for the rest of your life. So, yeah, looking back on wedding pictures, seeing, you know, friends you don't talk to anymore, it's kind of a bummer. So if you just rent someone, the pressure's not there.
Or you could just glue the faces of your new friends on top of the old ones and keep changing it out as the years go by.
Good idea.
I have ideas.
I'm going to do that right now. I'm quite crafty. I'm going to go for it. Thank you, Rachel.
Sure. Get out your glue stick.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.